Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. My name is Jeff Lee, and I'm the director of the Rocky Mountain Land Library. And on behalf of the Land Library and the Tattered Cover Bookstore, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's Land Series program. Tonight, we're very happy to welcome back Alan Weisman, author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, a comprehensive book that is the result of a worldwide search for solutions. Alan Weisman is an award-winning journalist and the author of several books, including the groundbreaking book that last brought him to this podium, The World Without Us, finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Author Craig Childs had this to say about tonight's book. Countdown tackles the biggest questions facing not only us, but every other living thing on this planet. Alan Weisman's tour of the globe offers both worst-case scenarios and the most hopeful futures we can imagine. Please join me in welcoming Alan Weisman.
Thank you so much. You know, the Tattered Cover is one of those places that everybody in the United States knows about this store. We're in a national treasure here, and I'm so grateful to be back. Thank you, and may you live long and keep selling books here. For any of you who don't know my last book that he mentioned, The World Without Us, I'll just explain that I actually wrote it because I wanted a world with us. The idea was this little thought experiment to theoretically wipe us off the planet in order to show how quickly the Earth could heal and refill empty niches when relieved of the daily pressures that we heap on it. My hope was that once readers saw this picture of a newly restored healthy planet, they'd be inspired to wonder if there might be a way to add us back into the picture, but in harmony, not constant combat with the rest of nature. But in trying to determine exactly what that nice natural balance might be, I ran into a troubling fact that every 4.5 days, we add 1 million more people to the planet. And that didn't sound very sustainable to me. So at the end of The World Without Us, I unexpectedly, I mean, even to me, tried another little thought experiment. I asked one of the world's most distinguished demographic institutes, which is in Vienna, to compute, setting all social implications aside, what would happen if we all participated in China's one-child policy. The surprising answer was that by the end of this century, we'd be back to about 1.6 billion, which was the population of the Earth at the beginning of the 20th century, before we doubled our numbers and then doubled again, all in one century, for reasons that I will explain shortly. Now, of course, that would give us and other species some breathing room. But, I mean, let's be serious. None of us want some government telling us what to do in our bedrooms or in our private lives. The nature part of human nature is to make more copies of ourselves, as it is with every other organism. So instinctively, the idea of being forced by someone else to put the brakes on doing what comes naturally is repellent. China's one-child policy, which was implemented in 1980, may be the reason why there are 400 million fewer Chinese today than there would have been otherwise. But realistically, a draconian policy like that won't fly hardly anywhere else. And then there's a question of whether it even matters that every year we add all those people, which is the equivalent of 4 more Beijings or 10 more New York Cities. There was a recent op-ed in the New York Times, some of you may have seen it, that argued exactly that. It said, no problem, because the more people there are, the more human ingenuity will have to solve the problems of how to feed more of us. Now, although that may sound like circular, if not downright magical thinking, a lot of pundits and economists believe that we can have our planet and eat it too. But the question I left dangling at the end of the world without us, namely, what is the sustainable carrying capacity of this planet for our species, factoring in our consumptive behavior, etc., that became one of the main things that people wanted to talk about. Now, as someone points out in this book, Countdown, the population question is the intersection between natural science and social science. Actually, it's more like the collision between them, because it's easy to grasp that in a national park, balance must be maintained between predator and prey, lest the ecosystem crash. When we're talking about our own species, it gets a lot harder, because we're hardly objective about ourselves, and all kinds of religious and other vested interests get involved. Nevertheless, I was surprised that the overwhelming majority of readers of that book, even including some economists and priests, were grateful that I had raised the issue. But it is such a loaded topic, fraught with conflicts between knowledge and instincts and emotion and beliefs. So finally I decided I had to really examine it. I had to examine not as an advocate or a foe of population management. And I could have said population control, but that in itself has become a very loaded term. But examine it as a journalist, researching and weighing the facts from as many sources as possible. If this book, Countdown, seems thick, it's partly because the last 100 pages are mostly my bibliography in the index. But along with all that literature, I had to research on the ground. I mean, for one thing, it's sometimes said that demographers, those social scientists who track and interpret population trends, are accountants without a sense of humor, since they're not adding or subtracting mere shekels, but us. Now, unless you're an accountant yourself, you don't find accounting to be entertaining reading. So in books on population, as important as the topic may be, just sound kind of boring or depressing. So, you know, even my agent actually warned me against writing about it, but one day, not being able to think of anything else, I just sat down in a hammock with a laptop, started to outline what a book on population might be like, and then I ended up with a 60-page book proposal that suddenly publishers were fighting themselves over. And what I proposed was that to research it, I would end up traveling the world. And I did, to 21 countries over 2 years, beginning in Israel and Palestine, ending in Iran, and with a lot of Europe and Asia and Africa and the Americas in between, in order to find not just facts, but evocative stories to make this book an irresistible and compelling read. Now, as for those facts, I don't pull any punches in this book. We are facing some serious challenges in this century, and much of it likely may be a pretty wild ride through uncharted territory. But the subtitle of this book is Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, and it ends with a question mark, because as a journalist, I don't make pronouncements. I ask questions, present what I find, and I let you readers decide whether what Countdown examines really is the last best chance we have. But I can tell you my conclusion about the hope part. I came out of this book far more encouraged than I went into it, because I found something easily affordable that we can actually do to make a huge difference. And there's already a lot of momentum and precedence for it in nearly every part of the world. Now, ultimately, my field research boiled down to four questions I ended up asking wherever I went. The questions were, number one, how many people can fit on this planet without capsizing it? Number two, the converse, how much nature must we preserve to ensure our own survival? Can we possibly know what other species are essential to us before we wipe out any more? Number three, is there anything in the histories, liturgies, or current circumstances of the broad swath of our world's cultures, religions, nationalities, etc., that might embrace the idea of, so to speak, refraining from embracing so much in times of crisis? And the reason why I traveled to so many places was to try to answer that one. And four, if the number is less than the nearly 11 billion that we're headed to by this century's end, or even less than the 7.2 billion we're already at, is there a way to design an economy that doesn't depend on perpetual growth in order to prosper, so that we might gradually bring our numbers down to a healthy level and keep them there? More than one expert I interviewed remarked that those may be the most important questions on Earth. But they invariably added, they also may be impossible to answer. My reply was, hey, impossible or not, if such questions are the most important ones on Earth, we damn well better try. But as I said, they are loaded. And that's especially true when there are political and religious pressures to be fruitful and multiply, to build a mighty tribe or nation. I start countdown by plunging into one of the hottest examples, Israel and Palestine, where the extremes of both are bent on outpopulating each other in a land, much of which is a sandbox. There are ultra-Orthodox Jews who are having double-digit families in hopes of becoming the majority in the land, versus what was once called Yasser Arafat's biology bomb. The PLO's secret weapon, he used to say, was the Palestinian womb. I began there because to Jew, Christian, Muslim alike, most of the people on this earth, this is hallowed ground, and it's a place that evokes powerful emotions in all of us. I figured it might get people's attention. Well, back during the British Mandate, before the State of Israel was created in 1947, British ecologists calculated the carrying capacity of the Holy Land to be 3.5 million people. Founding Zionist and first Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, however, argued that Jewish ingenuity could make the desert bloom. He believed the land could hold twice that, more than twice that much, 6 million. Well, today there are nearly 12 million jammed between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. And by the middle of this century, there'll be 21 million and a lot less water. Desalinization plants are already running nonstop. They're very energy intensive, and they produce more kosher sea salt than Israel can sell. And you don't want to dump it all back into the sea, lest you disrupt marine ecology. I met Israeli and Palestinian ecologists, water experts, demographers, and even religious clerics who are frightened about growing numbers. Both a rabbi and a Quranic scholar cited the story of Noah, whom God told that in order to save the human race, he also had to save all the animals. We can't have a world without them. But I also met the ultra-devout on all sides who believe that it's God's will to come out the winner of this demographic derby and that God will provide for everyone. Ecologists sometimes talk about something called the Netherlands fallacy, which is the fact that so many Dutch who live in Europe's most densely populated country, the fact that they have such a high standard of living is not proof that humans can thrive in essentially an unnatural artificial environment. Yet I heard that argued in Israel. One ecologist called it technological optimism, that they can solve anything if they put their minds to it. But like all of us, though, both the Dutch and the Israelis need things that only an ecosystem can provide, and they must purchase most of those things from somewhere else. The northern half of the Holy Land, by the way, where most Israelis live, is already twice as densely packed as Holland. Now, one ecologist who was also a Talmudic scholar cited the story of Joseph, born at a time when the Israelites were polygamists for the same reason that the Mormons later were. It's a strategy to have many children so the tribe can grow quickly. But then Joseph, who may have been our first ecologist, correctly observed that a time of scarcity was imminent. One of 13 children himself, he confined himself to one wife and just two children, and he advised Egypt's pharaoh that it was time for everyone to conserve in order to save themselves. And I have a modern example later on in the book. Among the countries that I visited that have discovered non-coercive, completely voluntary ways of bringing their population down is one that surprises a lot of people here because it's a Muslim theocracy. And, you know, one that, you know, we've heard is charter member of the evil empire. Now, the same year as its 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran actually applied coercion in the opposite direction, charging every fertile female to do her patriotic duty and get pregnant to help build a 20 million man army to fight off the invading Iraqis. And by some estimates, at one point, Iran's growth rate peaked at 4.2%, which is near the biological limits for fertile women, and the highest rate of population increase the world has ever seen. Now, amid the horror that we hear today about chemical weapons in Syria, occasionally someone recalls that Saddam Hussein used them first against his own Kurdish minority and then against Iran, which he had invaded for the same reason he later invaded Kuwait. Iran had this oil-rich province that he thought he could seize easily because the new Islamic Republic was just getting organized. Now, as you may know, NATO supplied Saddam Hussein's weaponry back then, including the feedstock for nerve gas. Iran, without much sophisticated weapons technology, simply responded with repeated waves of soldiers, enough to hold Iraq to a stalemate for 8 years. And today, wherever you go there, you see billboards filled with rows of pictures of locals who were among the million Iranians who were martyred in that war. But once it was finally over, the director of Iran's planning and budget office realized they had a big problem. All those males born to man the 20 million man army would eventually need jobs, and the chances for providing them shrank with each new birth. He and others met with the supreme leader to warn of the instability of a nation filled with frustrated, angry, under or unemployed young men. In short, a nation like today's Pakistan, where I also went. So soon thereafter, the country that had told its females to all get pregnant for the good of the nation was posting banners across the road reading, "One is good, two is enough." A new Ayatollah, he's still in power today, issued a fatwa stating that when wisdom dictates that you do not need more children, a vasectomy is permissible. A female OBGYN in Tehran told me what it was like being on these teams of doctors that went on horseback to health clinics in the remotest villages, and later by four-wheel drive and even helicopter, offering everything from condoms to pills to tubal ligations, all for free. But it was also all voluntary. Everyone could choose the number of children they wanted. The only obligation was to attend premarital counseling, either in a mosque or in the health center, which is frankly not a bad idea for anyone. In fact, the American Quakers also do this. And among the things that they discussed in those classes was how much it costs to feed, care for, and educate children. And I see the heads nodding. The other crucial part, though, of Iran's family planning program was encouraging women to stay in school, because women tend to postpone their childbearing until they complete their education. In fact, everywhere I went, even the poorest countries, female education turns out to be the most effective contraceptive of all. Because once she's out of school, a woman has some new and useful, interesting things to do with her life and a means to make a living for the family. You know, she wants to have children, but it's kind of hard to do all that with seven of them. So in Iran, where today 60% of university students are female, population growth came down to replacement rate, meaning two parents have two children and essentially replacing themselves, a year faster than China. The UN called it the most successful and humane family planning program on Earth, which makes it all the more frustrating that just as I was leaving the country, the Ayatollah Khomeini suddenly rescinded it. And time permitting, I can explain why later. It has partly to do with economic sanctions and some cold feet about what was happening to the Iranian economy. But every Iranian woman I met, secular or religious, was outraged. And I know that they hope that Iran's new reform-minded president will persuade him to reinstate it. Population only increases in two ways. more people are born than die, or people live longer, so they're still hanging around when others are born. And for much of human history, unfortunately, most babies didn't see their first birthday, and about half were dead by their fifth. I mean, imagine the pain of our ancestors. Now, the fact that population grew so slowly until about two centuries ago means that even though a woman might have seven or eight, the average number of children who survived long enough to have kids themselves was barely more than two. And the average life expectancy for humans was only about 40 years. But then in 1798, Edward Jenner discovered this vaccine for smallpox, which used to knock back our numbers by the millions. And that was soon eradicated by other, that was soon followed by other medical advances, more vaccines for more diseases, antiseptics, eradication of insects that carried epidemics, pasteurization of milk, and suddenly fewer were dying young and people were living longer. Now, none of us over 40 would ever argue that medical technology is a bad thing, because without it, most of us wouldn't be here. It's important to understand, though, that whenever we cure another disease, more people stay alive to beget more people. Now, for years, Bill and Melinda Gates, like many others, have dedicated much time and money to eradicate diseases such as HIV and malaria. And if you've ever witnessed the ravages of either, you'll pray that they'll succeed soon. But in recent years, the Gateses have come to realize that solving one problem would exacerbate another on a stressed and stretched planet. So now they are major funders of family planning. Because when there's too many of us, it's increasingly more complicated to keep ourselves and human civilization healthy. But an even more significant boost to our numbers than modern medical tech came from modern food technology. Just before World War II, two Germans, a chemist, Fritz Haber, and an engineer, Karl Bosch, invented something that has changed the world arguably more than anything else ever. And that was a way to pull nitrogen from the air and apply it chemically to soils. Before the Haber-Bosch process, the amount of plant life on this planet was limited to what of relatively few species, like legumes with roots that hosted nitrogen-fixing bacteria, could contribute to the soil. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer, derived from a double dose of fossil fuels, both as its feedstock and because it takes a lot of, it burns a lot of fuel to make the stuff, simply blew the lid off of what nature could do. Let me put it this way. More than 40% of us could not, would not be here without it. You take away artificial fertilizer and our population would be little more than half of what it is today. So small wonder that both those men won Nobel Prizes. To a certain extent, Fritz Haber mitigated the population spurt he unleashed by also inventing the mustard gas that Germany used in World War I. And a cyanide-based pesticide fumigant he created to use in grain storage was later refined by the Nazis into Zyklon B, which was the gas used in extermination camps, made in a factory that Karl Bosch headed. Both of those men were fervent anti-Nazis, but they lost control of their creations. And some would argue that that not only applies to nerve gas, but also to nitrogen fertilizer, which has downsides that we all now well know, because force-feeding our crops with chemicals sterilizes soils and fouls downstream waters, kills off New Jersey-sized chunks of the ocean at the mouths of the world's rivers, and it emits a lot of nitrous oxide, which after CO2 and methane is our most potent greenhouse gas. The Times op-ed that I mentioned earlier was titled, "Overpopulation is Not the Problem." In it, a geographer from Earl Ellis from the University of Maryland asserted that there's no environmental reason for people to go hungry now or in the future. Our ancestors, he explained, devised stone tools, fire, and finally agriculture to reshape ecosystems and provide more sustenance. And ever since, we've constantly contrived new food technologies to sustain more humans. Population growth itself, he argued, is the mother of invention, always stimulating us to coax more food from the land. Our planet's human carrying capacity, he concluded, emerges from our social systems and our technologies more than from any environmental limits. Now, when I read that, I thought, wow, what a comfort that must be to the planet's more than 1 billion hungry people. Because, unfortunately, as Pope Benedict XVI acknowledged in a 2009 encyclical, our social systems are doing an ever lousier job of sharing the bounty of the land. The Pope was particularly angered by a problem that maddens so many people who are trying to feed the world, that much of this food on the planet is not actually grown to feed people, but to make money. And the fact that so much of our agricultural prowess is devoted to producing a commodity and commodity as opposed to sustenance is why the commonly heard plea that we could feed everyone if only harvests were distributed more equitably just isn't very realistic. Nevertheless, like Mr. Ellis, Pope Benedict contended on this earth there's room for everyone through hard work and creativity. So in 2011, while researching this book, I visited the Vatican's Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which to the previous Pope's dismay had warned in 1994 that it was now, quote, unthinkable to sustain indefinitely a birth rate beyond 2 children per couple because the demographic consequences would be unsustainable to the point of absurdity. Nevertheless, the Church still encourages population growth. So where, I asked the Academy's current director, would we get food for the nearly 10 billion by mid-century with so many already malnourished? Wouldn't clearing more forests for farming be disastrous? Because, you know, beset by floods and erosion, China alone is spending $40 billion to put the trees back. And force-feeding crops with chemistry is backfiring on us. Well, the answer I was told would be through increased yields using new transgenic crops being designed at the centers of the Green Revolution. There's CIMMYT, which is the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center in Mexico, and IRI, the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. Now, I'm sure most of you know, back in the 1960s, just as burgeoning populations in the developing world were nearing the brink of famine, a miracle of genetic breeding occurred at those centers that more than doubled the world's grain harvest, in some cases increasing them up to tenfold. Green Revolution food technologies are often touted for debunking the dire predictions of inevitable famines as population growth outpaces food productions made by economist Thomas Robert Malthus and his latter-day analogs, ecologists Paul and Ann Ehrlich. Those are the ones who wrote the population bomb. But when I went to both CIMMYT and IRI, I met no food scientists who agreed with that. Actually, they said, in the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech given by Green Revolution founder Norman Borlaug, he warned that his work had essentially bought the world a generation of time to resolve overpopulation. There can be no permanent progress in the battle against hunger until the agencies that fight for increased food production and those who fight for population control unite in a common effort, his speech concluded. Later, Borlaug would be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal by the United States for having saved more lives than anyone in history. But he understood the paradox of food. The more we produce, the more people don't die of starvation, and they live to beget more people who need to be fed. So until his death in 2009, Borlaug served on the boards of population groups, because he'd seen that what Malthus had only theorized back in 1798 was coming true. Food production can't keep up with the very population growth that it helps to produce. So we have all these hungry people. And despite everybody's best efforts, it's going to probably get worse, because the first two places where the Green Revolution was tried were India and Pakistan, and both were saved from certain famine. But as a result, in about a decade, India will surpass China as the most populous nation on Earth. And Pakistan is one of the fastest growing. I met some wonderful people there, and one of the most hopeful stories in Countdown is from Pakistan. You can ask me about it later. But it's one of the scariest places on Earth right now. Pakistan today is 185 million people, in a country not much bigger than Texas, which has 26 million. By mid-century, if its growth continues apace, Pakistan will far outnumber today's United States. It'll have nearly 400 million people, all in a land the size of Texas. And a significant portion of them are these frustrated, angry, unemployed young men. Every day I was there, mayhem erupted, including several urban grenade battles. I lost one interview with two men who'd been saving Karachi's mangrove forests because the previous day they were found floating in the lagoon, tortured and murdered. At Karachi Civil Hospital, whose entrance is also a police station, armed guards are posted in the surgical theater lest warfare erupt in the triage units. I mean, it's Pakistan's waxing out of control, and it happens to be a nuclear power. In India, the head of the Punjab State Farm Commission, who directed the implementation of India's Green Revolution back in the 60s, told me that the three biggest problems in the country were population, and you know where that's going. Three farmers who I met in his office took me to their villages, where I spent a day mostly interviewing widows of farmers who killed themselves because the levels in the 50-foot wells originally dug to water Green Revolution crops had dropped to 500 and even 1,000 feet and beyond, and they couldn't afford to keep drilling. According to figures from their farm union, corroborated by the Indian government, 270,000 Green Revolution farmers have committed suicide since 1995. And overwhelmingly, the symbolic method of choice is by drinking pesticide. Half our people are sick from pesticides. Heart attacks, high blood pressure, cancer, the farmers told me. Our kids have skin diseases and bad eyesight. No matter how much they eat, they're anemic. Their teachers call them slow learners. And their fathers are all 200 rupees in debt on every acre. Every one of them is suicide in waiting. We're all on each other's suicide watch. Now, today, more than half the human race doesn't live on farms. They live in cities, compared to only a third of us back in 1950. Now, since kids in urban areas aren't an economic asset to parents like they are on the farms, where they become farmhands, it's widely assumed that world population would level off around 9.2 billion by mid-century. But even though we're growing more slowly, there are already so many of us that this past June, the UN's Population Division's latest revision projects that our numbers will keep growing, hitting nearly 11 billion by the end of this century, with no sure peak in sight. In the next 50 years, Norman Borlaug's successor in the Weed Improvement Program told me, we need to produce as much food as has been consumed over our entire human history. And they were trying. Geneticists there and at Erie showed me what the Vatican was talking about, these experiments to hot rod photosynthesis in hopes of increasing plant productivity up to 50% more over the previous Green Revolution yields, and possibly even give grains enough energy to fix their own nitrogen so they wouldn't need as much fertilizer. But everyone acknowledges that even if they can do this, the viable enhanced photosynthesizing crops are about 20 to 25 years away, and by then there's going to be 2 billion more of us. And agroengineers face other growing problems spawned by growing populations that as ever more of us expel more carbon, our atmosphere heats up, grains have temperature thresholds, so for every 1 degree centigrade of warming, many scientists told me harvests are expected to drop 10%. And with our world now headed beyond 2 degrees centigrade at present emission rates, population will be up, food production down, irrigation water scarcer, and coastal dikes may have to protect much of the world's rice production, which is near sea level, which is probably unaffordable. And the predictions that northern Canada and Siberia will be bread baskets in a warmer world neglect that their conifer-covered acidic soils will take millennia to adapt to the needs of crops. So, some of you may be wondering, because, you know, vegans scream constantly that we could feed everybody if we, you know, weren't devoting so much of our grain to production for animal feed. At one point in my book, I do look at the prospect for this vegan dream called test tube meat. But even artificial meat has to come from something. So currently there are experiments using things like blue-green algae and pig stem cells, and in Japan, human waste as feedstock. But just like jet-propelled photosynthesizers, the guess is that commercial viability is 20, 30 years off. So with 40% of the non-frozen terrestrial Earth now dedicated to feeding ourselves, everywhere I went, I spent a lot of time researching the second crucial question: how much nature do we need to preserve our own viability? How will we know if we push something off this planet that we didn't realize we needed until too late? In Countdown, we go to Latin America and China, where ecologists in a worldwide effort called the National Capital Project have shown something rather wonderful: that croplands closest to forests do much better than those farther away. In Costa Rica, coffee yields from bushes adjacent to rainforests were 20% higher than plants a kilometer away, because birds, bats, native bees, and reptiles were pollinating and providing pest control. And conversely, a surprising number of species, not everything, of course, because many large mammals have disappeared, but a great many others nonetheless appear to be hanging on in the ribbons of remaining forests and farm landscape. So as our pristine wilderness grows too fragmented to sustain everything, the natural capital people believe that the future of biodiversity, and likely ourselves, will be determined by what happens in agricultural countrysides that are maintained in balance with some of the original nature there. So in Nepal, for example, where overpopulation is not just a human but a bovine problem, as cows are sacred and can't be killed, I saw this ingenious World Wildlife Fund funded old cow's home that gave aging beasts a dignified final chapter rather than keeping them working till they drop with arthritis ointment that had proved toxic to endangered species of vultures. The cows get a proper Hindu funeral. Their untainted carcasses feed the newly replenished thriving vulture populations. In the Philippines, surrounded by the world's biologically richest seas, despite a national government that has long genuflected to the world's most conservative Catholic bishops, there's one Manila suburb that now sends men to prison for 6 months if they buy condoms without a prescription. I saw fishing villages that are taking family planning into their own hand. They're coming to understand that if they want to keep fishing, which is the source of 90% of protein in the Philippines, they have to keep the number of fishermen in balance with fish stocks. Across the water in Japan, the last wild oriental white stork had vanished in 1971. About 18 years later, a stork hatchery in Toyuka, is a town an hour from Kyoto, successfully reproduced some using breeding pairs from Russia. But the local rice fields, which are soaked each year with organomercury pesticides, were too toxic for the fledgling birds to be released. So they stayed there. In 2004, a 10-year-old schoolgirl named Yuka Okada heard that storks, like those caged birds in Toyuka's hatchery, had once filled the skies and nested on every chimney. After learning why they no longer did, she went to the mayor and demanded that Toyuka serve organic rice for school lunches. Now, to do that meant eliminating mercury, inviting back grasshoppers, but also making the rice paddies safe for storks. The mayor, upon hearing the simple truth from a 10-year-old, could only agree. His city's slogan became, "An environment good for storks must be good for humans, too." The next plantings were pesticide-free. And a year later, the first stork was released, and today, wherever they nest, the rice is twice as valuable because the presence of storks guarantee its purity. An economy that bottomed out was rejuvenated, and today tourists flock to Toyuka to watch hundreds of storks do the same. Now, is this just a little story about a luxury food item, high-end organic rice? Actually not. This is a scenario that a Japanese economist named Akihiko Matsutani believes that Japan is headed to as one of the first countries on Earth whose population has begun to shrink. The reason is that 4 years after World War II, Japan had to cut off its baby boom. You may recall that it started that war in the first place by invading Manchuria because its rapidly growing population needed more room. And of course, Germany invaded Poland and also exterminated millions whom it considered undesirable for the same reason. So when the war ended, Japanese soldiers went home, and like ours, they took up with their wives where they left off. Japan's wartime population, which was 72 million, soon spurted to 83 million. But having lost, Japan's economy was wrecked, and people were starving. So in 1949, in an emergency measure, Japan legalized abortion. Remember, this was before birth control pills. And millions of Japanese women partook, lest they watch more babies die of hunger. So today, as the aged large generation preceding those truncated baby boomers dies off, there's a much smaller generation to replace them. And you add to that Japan's high education and the low fertility that naturally follows that, and just past the middle of the century, Japan will be back to its 1945 population. And many Japanese economists are terrified by that. But Matsutani, who's no radical but an economist at a major policy institute, sees an opportunity. When I met him, Japan had just compounded its shrinkage by losing its most fertile fruit-growing area, Fukushima, and all of its nuclear power. Matsutani envisions a gradual realignment away from heavy exporting industries and big crowded port cities to a dispersed economy of lighter industries and agriculture distributed across a landscape that younger people are starting to return to as empty homes vacated by that dying overgrown population are becoming available and cheap. Lifestyle, he predicts, will actually improve. Wages won't drop because laborers will be fewer and more valuable. But working hours will also be fewer as demand shrinks with population. So prosperity will be redefined to mean having more leisure time to enjoy rather than being able to afford more consumer toys to occupy during far too little downtime. And this is not a bad vision of a workable future, though most economists can't imagine it, because the definition of economic health is perpetual growth. Now, while I was there, I was asked by a well-known Japanese business magazine if I thought that people were being hysterical to demand an end to nuclear power in the wake of the Fukushima tragedy. Well, given that all your nuclear plants are in seismic zones or in seacoast exposed to typhoons and tsunamis, I said I wouldn't call it hysteria. He says, but people will suffer even more if productivity drops. Isn't it hysterical not to take that into account? He countered, and for the next half hour, he kept rephrasing his question, hoping for a more satisfying response, until during his fourth try, the coffee shop where we sat shook as a tremor struck central Tokyo, rendering my reply unnecessary. Now, the same magazine reports plans to rebuild all the fishing ports destroyed by the tsunami, even though Matsutani argues, look, that's going to take 20 years to do, and by then there's only going to be a quarter of the fishermen still alive, so three-fourths of the port facilities won't be needed. But so far, nobody seems to be thinking about anything beyond this year's contracts, not what the world will need in 20 years. The late economist Julian Simon, who was known for preaching that human ingenuity ensured that resources would never run out, famously won a 1980 bet with Paul Ehrlich that the prices of five commodity metals wouldn't rise due to growing scarcity over the coming decade. Now, as The Economist magazine later reported, in subsequent decades, Ehrlich would have won, and yet their bet is still cited to discredit his warnings. Also, Simon refused a bet that Ehrlich proposed on five environmental indicators, including global temperature, crop yields, and human sperm counts. In 1994, Simon, ever the cornucopian, declared, "We now have the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years." Now, with the world population then growing by 1.4% annually, Paul and Ann Ehrlich did the math and responded, that was unlikely because at current rates, within 6,000 years only, the mass of human population would equal the mass of the universe. It's true. Now, look, otherwise intelligent people spout such nonsense because humans have never had to think about limits before. We're not used to it. Economists warn that if population ever stopped growing, there will be too few young laborers paying into pension funds to support too many old people. And for a generation or two, you know, there's something to that. Until at least, like in Japan, the generations would then start to come back into balance. But until that happens, we're just going to have to adjust. I never said this would be simple, but nothing in the 21st century is going to be. But we can do this gradually and acceptably. And frankly, I can think of a lot of things that my country has blown money on in the past couple of decades, such as those parties that we threw in Iraq and Afghanistan, that could be better spent on taking care of senior citizens for a generation or so. So here's the bottom line. If we keep on the way we're going and growing, we will add 2.5 billion people in the next 35 years. But because we've already used up the best lands and the cheapest energy sources, they're going to have a much bigger and dirtier impact than the last 2.5 billion. And yes, I know that population increase is mainly among the world's poor, who don't pack anywhere near as much of an environmental wallop as we do. The richest fifth of the world's people consume up to 66 times as much as the poorest fifth. But our numbers have now reached a point where we've essentially redefined the concept of original sin. Because from the instant we're born, even the humblest among us compounds the world's mounting problems by needing food, firewood, and shelter. And literally and figuratively, we're all exhaling CO2 and pushing other species over the edge. The world's masses may be poor, but more of them are living in cities where somehow they manage to get cell phones. And whether they've pirated the power or not, they're plugging in their chargers every night, the same as you and me. Nevertheless, it's true that we, the comparatively affluent, are many orders of magnitude beyond that, because if we multiply our numbers by the amount that we consume, it turns out that you and I are sitting in the most overpopulated country on Earth. So the reason I wrote this book was not to ask if we can support 11 billion that we're headed to, but whether we're already too many and what we might do about it. Because every species in biology that exceeds the limits of its resource base suffers a population crash, sometimes a fatal one. So I sincerely doubt we're going to make it to 11 billion. Because one way or another, our population is going to come down. Either we manage it gracefully or nature is going to do it to us. Now here's the good news. We can fix this and give a serious respite to our precious environment, without which we cannot live, for less money each year than my government, and probably yours, was spending our tax dollars on in a month in Afghanistan and Iraq. That amount, about $8.5 billion annually, would let us provide contraception for everyone on Earth who wants it. In this book, I accompany people who make contraceptives available in places like Uganda and Thailand, where women desperately want and need them, and also the people who pay for them. I was staggered to learn how few the donors are, mainly a few Western governments and four private foundations, and how fragile the supply lines are. If a shipment of birth control pills or Depo-Provera injections don't arrive, or the truck breaks down, or they get hijacked, or they disappear from the warehouse, as you women well know, you miss one crucial dose and all those careful efforts are for naught. The U.S. is the biggest donor of all. And look, I belong to no political party, but if someone else had won the last presidential election, Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan assured their base that much of that crucial largesse would have been canceled. And here's what could happen if we failed to provide it. Without contraception reaching those women in the developing world, our ranks would expand by 1 million more hungry humans, not every 4.5 days, but every 2.5 days. That's 7 more Beijings a year instead of 4. Put another way, forget those UN projections about 11 billion, because just a half a child more per woman, and we'll be headed at the end of the century to 16 billion. But a half a child less, if we provide contraception for all. And by the way, I do discuss in here the promising new and far simpler male contraceptives that are coming ready. And yeah, with contraception available to all, we'd be back down to 6 billion, half a child less per woman, well on our way to a sustainable future for our species, which each decade will be easier, not harder, to feed. Now, does that sound far-fetched? Look, I fear that it's a lot easier than coming up with zero-emission energy. And we've been trying to tap free sunlight, et cetera, for years, and we're still nowhere near capable of running all of our industries and our cities and our vehicles and our Chinas and our Indias on it. Nor do we know how to do something even more magical, convince everyone to consume less. There's no condom for consumption yet. By the time that happens, we convince everybody, I fear our world would long be trashed. But this, however, is technology that we already have. It's nothing that requires some enormous leap. As one of our most brilliant physicists, Carnegie's Ken Caldera, once told me, if we build a 900-megawatt zero-emission plant every day for the next 50 years, we still couldn't keep up with demand, and we still don't even know how to build one. But you combine contraception with education for females, and we will tap one of the richest human resources of all. The same Viennese Demographic Institute I mentioned earlier recently calculated that if female education were universally available, there would be 1 billion fewer of us, not by the end, but by the middle of this century. And think of how all those educated women would help those feared labor shortages during a demographic transition back to sanity. At one point in Countdown, I quote former World Bank economist Herman Daly on designing an economy that can prosper without perpetual growth, which one day we must have because we live on a planet that doesn't grow. The switch to sustainable economy, Daly wrote, would entail an enormous change of mind and heart by economists, politicians, and voters. And one might be tempted to declare such a prospect would be impossible. But the alternative to a sustainable economy, an ever-growing economy, is biophysically impossible. So in choosing between tackling a political impossibility or a biophysical impossibility, I judge the latter to be even more impossible, and I'll take my chances with the former. Now, what my research for Countdown has led me to conclude that I think we need to do, it's actually easier than that. Because the majority of places and people on this planet are already doing it. More than half the countries in the world are at, near, or below replacement rate. And we can do what it takes inexpensively to bring the rest there too. And by making it available so everyone can choose the number that they want, gradually bring us down to a truly sustainable number, rather than ask how we're going to do the impossible. Feed them all when we can't even feed the ones that we have without messing up our planet even more. I want to conclude by reading you just a short little story from this book that speaks to that second crucial question of how much nature do we need? For centuries, the cultural fabric of Iran has been woven by Persian carpet makers. In Turkish rugs, each strand of yarn is knotted around two warp strands. But in Persian rugs, one weft per each warp, they're twice as tight. The tightest are still made today, that are still made today have 144 knots per square centimeter. A rug like that of wool from the bellies of spring lambs can take two people 8 years to finish. In Tehran's Carpet Museum hang old masterpieces created for royal families with 160 knots per centimeter, woven by girls with sharp eyes and tiny fingers. One fabulously complex floral pattern that measures 320 square feet took three people working 10 hours a day, 18 years to complete. The principal weaver was 17 when she started and 35 when it was finished. Now, as a biology student in the 60s, Esmail Karom would stare at rugs in the museum, such as one completed in 1416 that depicts the Tree of Life, which is a Zoroastrian symbol that predates Islam. Among its branches, he recognized turkeys, bustards, vultures, mynas, owls, doves, thrushes, flamingos, swallows, quail, parrots, ostriches, and partridges. And around the trunk crawled bears and turtles, alligators, beetles, centipedes, lions, and leopards. The depictions were so detailed that zoologists could determine each species. He was looking, Karom understood, at creatures now extinct in his land. The eyes of the ancient carpet weavers are how Iranian biologists know today what once lived there. Esmael Karom was the son of an Air Force pilot who, like his mother, was one of 12 children. As a boy, Karom's father would take him riding in Chosh Yalag, which is a wildlife refuge that means good summer pasture, just south of the Caspian Sea. The grass there grew so tall that he would lose sight of the park ranger guide and have to stand on his horse's back to see where the stalks were moving to know which way to go. Chosh Yalag then was home to the largest population of cheetahs in Iran, and the sight of the fleet creatures thrilled him, and he resolved to become a naturalist. After graduating from the University of Shiraz, he became a field ornithologist with the Department of the Environment and traveled to every ecosystem in Iran. Eventually, he was appointed director of the Bureau of Wildlife and began a weekly television program that introduced viewers to the natural wonders of their country. The government sent him to England for graduate studies, and after he returned with a doctorate, he taught ecology both in college and through the media. His TV documentaries made Esmael Karom Iran's best-known naturalist. He took viewers to places like Miankale, a 48-kilometer sandy peninsula that's the last stretch of natural shoreline along Iran's Caspian Sea coast. In the early 17th century, Shah Abbas of Persia's Safavid dynasty once killed 90 leopards and 30 tigers there. In 1830, Nasser al-Din Shah of the Qajar dynasty, who had 85 wives, wrote that early one spring morning, he watched millions of migrating birds darken the skies for 4 hours. 50 years later, one of his many sons would take a group of friends to Miankala. With newly invented high-powered rifles, they shot 6,000 pheasants, 150 deer, 63 buffaloes, 18 leopards, and 35 tigers. And that same prince later described an area outside the city of Shiraz where hundreds of men hunted day and night. The mountain is so rich in wildlife, he wrote in his memoirs, that if the numbers of hunters were 10 times over, there would still be enough game animals for everybody. We stayed here for 2 months, and when we were leaving, the number of animals was still the same. Now, statements like these, Karam told his audiences, prove that the Qajar hunters never set out to eradicate entire species of wild animals. In fact, they hoped to hunt forever. They considered natural resources, such as wildlife and forests, to be renewable resources that simply could not be exterminated by man. But all the species they prize now are rare or threatened or extinct. The mighty lion, the Caspian tiger, the Iranian wild ass, gazelles, bighorn mountain sheep, leopards, and the cheetah. Yes, the cheetah, he says, passing a plate of figs. The walls in his home near Tehran's Islamic Assad University, where he teaches, are trimmed with ornate molding, hung with brass wall sconces and chandeliers. Small Persian rugs cover hardwood floors. The brick fireplace is flanked by paintings of migrating cranes and the endangered red-breasted goose that winters in Miankale. And above the mantel is a 19th century Tabriz tapestry that declares in graceful Farsi calligraphy that God is the greatest protector of all. And whenever Karom, who's this dapper man with a sandy mustache, when he's confronted by someone demanding to know whether it really matters if cheetahs disappear from the face of the earth or if tigers go extinct, he tells him about one particular cheetah. It was where he least expected to encounter one. It was January 2003, and he was visiting America for the first time. A cousin in San Diego had married a school teacher who invited him to observe a sixth grade class. He was charmed that the teacher had brought an Iranian flag and some Iranian coins to show the students. When next she unrolled an exquisite crimson rug, his eyes widened because the rug, he knew immediately, was a pure silk paisley pattern from the holy city of Gome, were thousands. Our guest is an ecologist, she told her students. Ecology, she explained, is the science of knowing how everything on Earth, people, plants, animals, fungi, microbes, rocks, soil, water, and air is connected. All over the world, there are people who protect animals and plants so that the connections don't break. Dr. Karom is one of them. There was a knock on the classroom door, And Carome gasped, along with the sixth graders, as another teacher entered, accompanied by a curator from the San Diego Zoo. The leash he held was attached to a muzzled cheetah. "There are two populations of cheetah," said the teacher, "one in Africa, the other in Asia. The Asiatic cheetah today lives only in Iran." Carome was amazed that this American woman knew something that he wished his own people comprehended. "So what do you think would happen," she asked, "if the Asiatic cheetahs disappeared from the earth? Would it be a disaster? Would we be in trouble? Would you still be able to go to school? Would there still be gasoline for your father's car? Will we have electricity and water? Should we be concerned?" The students agreed that this elegant creature, silent on its haunches before them, deserved to live. But none thought that the world would come crashing down along with the cheetahs in the event that it didn't. The teacher turned to the glowing silk gom rug draped on an easel. She said, "This beautiful Persian carpet belongs to an Iranian who lives in San Diego. It's made with more than 1.5 million knots. It took women years to do that. Now suppose some boy with a pair of scissors cuts a few knots from its edge. What'll happen?" "Nothing. You wouldn't even notice it." "Now suppose he returns and makes 200 knots disappear. Probably you wouldn't notice it among the 1.5 million. But what if he keeps doing it? Soon you'll have a small hole. Then it'll get bigger and bigger. And eventually nothing will be left of this carpet." Extending her arm, she pointed at the La Jolla foliage outside and at the cheetah that was watching her as raptly as her students and Carome. "All this is the carpet of life. You are sitting on it. Each of those knots represents one plant or animal. They and the air we breathe, the water we drink, and our groceries are not manufactured. They are produced by what we call nature. This rug represents that nature. And if something happens in Asia or Africa and a cheetah disappears, that's one knot from the carpet. And if you understand that, you will realize that we are living on a very limited number of species and resources on which our life depends. Thank you very much."
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.